Today on Vox Talks Economics, the euro at 25. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Follow us on Instagram as well. On the 1st of January 1999, the exchange rates between the franc, the peseta, the Deutschmark, the lira, seven other currencies as well, were permanently fixed. The euro had been launched. In the 25 years that have followed, despite several moments when it seemed the entire project might implode, the euro has proved to be extremely resilient. So what have we learned from the first 25 years about the strengths and the weaknesses of Europe's economic and monetary union? And how can the euro continue to thrive in the next quarter of a century? Marco Butti and Giancarlo Corsetti of the European University Institute are the authors of a CEPR policy insight that has attempted to answer these questions and others. And they join me now. Marco, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tim.
And Giancarlo, welcome as well.
Thank you.
With Beethoven's Ode to Joy and with champagne, the supercurrency was launched.
Marco, the recent passing of Jacques Delors, it reminded many of us of that generation of politicians whose life work was about creating a stronger and a more unified Europe, and that included the Euro project. In the 1990s, when the Euro was first dreamed up, what did the architects believe that a single currency could achieve?
Actually, the passing of Jacques Delors took place at the same time as the passing of Wolfgang Schäuble, virtually the same day.
Yes.
And it is telling, in a sense, because both had an idea of a more unified Europe. When we created the euro back in 1999, and the project had been actually ongoing since the approval of the Maastricht Treaty, the idea was indeed to create a more unified Europe. Some, as we say in the paper, thought that this would bring nirvana. I think the official line at the Commission, the euro enthusiasts saw the future as extremely bright, and sharing sovereignty on the monetary side would bring sharing sovereignty on the rest also, prompting all the reforms that which would put Europe on a higher growth path. There were skeptics, clearly, at the time, but the official line was here, we are responding to the call of history. So it was anchoring Germany to the core of Europe, for them giving up the Deutschmark, but joining a currency area based on strong stability was what was the project. And that went hand in hand with completing the single market, which was, the second huge project that associated with Jacques Delors.
And at the time, were the economists convinced by this vision of nirvana that was linked to the euro?
Convinced by nirvana, I would not say so. But remember, economists were actively involved in the debate. Some of the economists were actually proposing various way of monetary and economic integration, weighing heavily on the debate. I guess the persuasion of the economists started to crack about the modalities of the integration. But at the end of the day, what was the crux of the debate was whether countries were ready in different ways to integrate, but most important, how to bring them together. And that was where the sticky point came in the debate. So I would say that the economists were convinced in the long run about the project, but the way to go there created lots of reservation.
Yes, and as we've been discussing on Vox Talks many times, sometimes it seemed like we didn't discuss much else. The euro was created with a common monetary framework, but the individual national governments kept control of fiscal policy. Did at the time the designers of the euro, did they think that this wouldn't cause any problems, or was it the best that they could achieve at that moment?
Yes, there was awareness. Actually, there was awareness also in the policymaker, not only amongst the economists, that the architecture of the euro was somehow incomplete.
Yeah.
But there were two views, sometimes talked about explicitly, in other cases, especially in policy, for more implicitly. There were two views on how to complete monetary union. On the one hand, there was the German view, which was based on the expectations that pooling monetary sovereignty, depriving euro area members of the exchange rate and independent monetary policy, would then trigger reforms in other areas so that the adjustment would be made at the national level in a smooth manner. It was the TINA theory. There is no alternative than making the structural reforms which would allow member states to adjust to shocks properly. Then there was the opposite view, and was more associated with the French view, is that, look, the euro architecture is incomplete. We are going to complete it in due course by setting up a euro area budget, also counting on the understanding, in the inverted commas, that ECB independence would then respond properly when the shocks come. And at the end of the day, it will be the policymakers, ECB makers in Frankfurt would behave. So there were basically these two views. One bottom-up, as we say in the paper, the German one, and one top-down, a bit more like the French. At the end of the day, neither of the two views were fulfilled. And the project is still in the making. Yeah. I think we have made great strides, but the chantier of economic and monetary union is still open, and there are big challenges in front of us.
Yeah, before we move on, Mark, I want to ask you, if I'm correct, you were working in the Commission at the time the euro was launched. What do you remember the emotion was like there? Was it fear? Were people excited? Were they afraid it wouldn't work?
There was certainly great excitement. Mm-hmm. I have to say, we came at the time of the period of the 1970s with the two oil price shocks, stagflation, what was called eurosclerosis at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination in the second half of the 1980s between the 1992 project of completing the single market, the single currency, which was seen as a complement of the single market, plus the huge historical events linked to the reunification of Europe, the fall of the Berlin Wall, etc., created clearly a great excitement. We thought we were there pushing the frontier of history. That was very tangible at the time. So certainly, especially the European Commission, where the blueprint was designed, we thought that, yes, a lot of technocratic work at the services of a much bigger dream.
In 2022, we spoke to Jen Gardel, along with Agnès Benassi-Kervé, about the implications of above-average inflation in the euro area. Did their predictions come true? To find out, listen to Inflation and Europe's Public Finances from June 2022.
So, what happened next? Let's focus on the years before the global financial crisis, during the Great Moderation, maybe the first decade, I suppose, of the euro's existence. Did it deliver on its promise during this time?
A lot of excitement, the euro sails on. But remember, the euro sails on with a very small constitution, economic constitution. Basically, independence of ECB with a clear mandate, a no bailout clause, and basically the Stability and Growth Pact. The ECB was in charge of monetary policy, but everything else was delegated to states that had to undergo the necessary reforms.
Mm-hmm.
So the first decade of the euro was the euro of the great moderation, and I would say also the great misallocation. Everything was flowing very easily, a very small interest rate differential across sectors, across individuals, many subjects that would never have credit, maybe access to credit. So this great misallocation in Europe was similar to the US, but it had also a very strong geographical differential. You see what we call the periphery or the south of Europe or the future crisis countries investing very heavily in real estate and the North keep going, investing still in manufacturing and other sector, but especially financing the big real estate investment in the South. So money went to the what we call the wrong sector, but also using the wrong instrument, which is basically short-run banking flows. This was not only in Europe. In Europe had the problem that they had this geographical connotation. And on top of that, Europe, when the crisis came, had much less instruments to absorb the consequence of the misallocation than in other regions where fiscal and monetary policy could be integrated.
So in 2008, we have the global financial crisis. What around that time became apparent were the weaknesses in the way that the euro had been constructed?
Well, you can make a list of what was not included in the Constitution of Europe, like a banking union, crisis mechanism, regulation of markets to a certain extent. All I'm saying is that once everything is delegated to national states, and it's made very clear that we will never go to a federation, as there was the initial Constitution of Europe, meaning there was basically no sense of pushing out the integration at some level of fiscal policy, then we lack the instruments to deal with the problem. So especially we lack the instrument, we lack the resources, we lack the determination, we lack the institutional framework, but especially we lack the cooperation among national policymakers. The clear victim of the crisis was trust across policymakers. And in part in the paper, we sort of stress the fact that, let's say, it is odd the crisis in Europe started with the fiscal crisis in Greece instead of a banking crisis in Ireland or other places. The fact that started with a fiscal crisis marked by alleged cheating on the budget, it really contributed to the dissipation of any residual trust among policymakers. That made the next few years dealing with the shock, dealing with the crisis, extremely difficult at the European level.
We are racing through history here, but in the years that followed, I remember there was regular speculation that the euro was going to collapse, that some countries were going to leave the euro. What held the euro together in the end?
I remember very vividly. I mean, I was in my office in Brussels at the time as Director General in the Commission, and I remember the CNN covering the euro area crisis live, you know, once when they pulled up or, you know, bank hostages, etc. So it was indeed the markets thought and speculated on the euro not surviving, but not surviving in the next 25 years, not surviving till the next week.
Yeah.
That was the actual feeling. I think the markets underestimated heavily and burnt their fingers the political capital that had been invested in Europe and in the euro. That generation of policymakers eventually found the courage to do what was needed. In particular, you will remember the three famous words, you know, whatever it takes, of July 2012. That was the feeling. What is interesting, and we documented in the paper, is that whilst the euro was undergoing this existential crisis threatening its survival, the euro area continued to expand. Mm-hmm. And there, I think there was certainly some economic consideration, but especially what was key was the geopolitical and geostrategic reasoning behind that. Look at that in retrospect now with what is happening in Ukraine. The fact that in that period, the three Baltic countries joined the euro area was actually to join the core of European integration as a way to protect themselves from the very threatening neighbor. So that was, I think, an important element. But clearly, the management of the crisis, as Giancarlo recalled, because of the original sin, left then to the kind of pound of flesh that was extracted from the countries which had to undergo adjustment programs supported by the IMF and the EU. It was this paradigm which expired, which went away when the COVID hit the Europe and the Eurozone.
Now, before then, there was a period of reform, wasn't there? Because everyone was acutely aware of what you call the original sin. Did those reforms go far enough to fix the institutional weaknesses?
They went part of the way. I mean, certainly banking union with the establishment of the first pillar, the SSM, with the second pillar, the single resolution mechanism, went a long way in setting the goals and the operational mechanisms, but they were not completed. So one thing that we have learned from Europe is that, in a sense, the Jean Monnet dictum is there at work, namely that we make big strides when we are under threat. Mm-hmm. But the second half of the Jean Monnet prediction is that as soon as the shock and the pressure is lifted, then the temptation to roll back is very strong. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why with banking union, we went a certain way, but we were not able to complete it. So this is one element. The second element, which characterized the institutional response during the great financial crisis as a sovereign debt crisis, was the intergovernmental nature of a number of institutions and rule books that were, you know, adopted at the time. So the ESM, very much intergovernmental. So with the need of national parliaments to ratify any decision of support, which led to the ultima ratio, as we say in the paper, also the fiscal compact, which toughens the fiscal rules, which also are intergovernmental nature. And we know very well, intergovernmentalism does not go down well in terms of building trust.
There is also an important, I would say, intellectual point made through the crisis, which is, what is the minimal constitutional requirement for a monetary union? The first answer was every country should do its own job, should do their reform, their homework, and we can live with an independent monetary policymaker, basically. The answer clearly was not satisfactory, was not resilient, was not stable. And the crisis showed that we needed to have important changes. I remember very vividly that at some point the euro was dubbed a foreign currency for euro members. There was loss of sovereignty in the monetary sense in the euro members. And it took some time to understand that that was not true. And it took an important change in the way the ECB operates with the outright monetary transaction. Also, it took all this intergovernmental initiative to understand that we need transfers of some kind to ensure stability in the interest of everybody in the euro, not because the fragmentation and the crisis through decades created losses that are vastly avoidable through a joint action, not containing instability in the markets and containing fragmentation within Europe. So that was a breakthrough that could not happen in the first decade of the euro just because we were distracted.
Eventually, COVID presented the challenge, the opportunity for massive collective fiscal action in the euro area. It would have seemed extremely unlikely before the COVID crisis. Has that created more of an appetite for this type of reform, this type of collective fiscal action?
The response to COVID was clearly a breakthrough of enormous proportion. One should never underestimate the kind of red lines that have been crossed when COVID hit the Europe, the European economy. It is telling to understand why the response was a different one, different not only in size, but also in sign, was the fact that unlike the global financial crisis and the sovereign debt crisis, COVID is seen as an exogenous shock. So it is not due to, you know, mistakes that were made in terms of policies. Clearly, one can always attribute COVID to capitalism, globalization, and things. You can go back to the very first origin. But in terms of, you know, proximate reasons, it was not due to policymakers' mistakes. So this led to the paradigm of moral hazard, which dominated during the global financial crisis, to get out of the window immediately. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we had the response on the monetary side, the PEP program, and on the fiscal side at the European level, sure, so to support the labor markets and Next Generation EU, which is, you know, 750 plus billion. So this was clearly a breakthrough. However, what we say in the paper is that this took political courage, but it was on the back of what we call a benign coincidence. Mm. So beside the nature of the shock, there was also a political calendar which was extremely favorable. So there were no elections looming. And the three main characters in the policymaking at the European level, Emmanuel Macron Angela Merkel and Ursula von der Leyen had in front of them, for different, sometimes opposite reasons, had in front of them a long time horizon. So, as we say in the paper, they had a very low political discount rate, that they could look to the future and not being worried about the domestic repercussions because we have an election in the Länder in 2 months' time. So this peaceful political calendar actually helped the decision making. And if one judges then ex post, at the end of the day, this benign coincidence helped a lot more than the actual change of structural preferences, which are still there. It's something to build on, but one should not take it as automatic. Now we are going to proceed to fiscal union, to complete banking union without further political advancement and efforts.
Okay, so making ex post judgments is really what we're all about today. So I wanted to ask you if you can look back on the last 25 years of the euro. This original sin, the incompleteness of the institutional framework, how economically damaging has that been?
Well, we cannot make it counterfactual, so we don't know what would have happened without yes. the euro. That would have been the way to answer your question. But, you know, with lots of sympathy for the project, we cannot close our eyes on the fact that the minimal constitution of Europe, the very start of Europe, done with a sense of urgency, with a sense that there is no alternative to the decision taken in the Madrid summit, that kind of rushing into the euro had some consequences. We cannot really blame the euro for the misallocation in the first decade. It was everywhere. We can, however, think of an alternative scenario in which better instruments at the European level would have moderated the flow of capital in the wrong sectors, would have helped using risky financing, no risky instrument rather than bank loans. But again, this is a parallel universe. Most important, at the beginning of the great financial crisis, the lack of instrument made the shock much, much larger, persistent, disruptive in Europe than in other regions of the world. So there was a price to pay for the scrambling to find the solution out of a crisis, the famous paradigm in Europe. And there is a lesson there, which is leaping forward through crisis may be a pattern that may work for some time, but it's not costless. We may not be able to afford it in the future when one can reasonably expect a variability, not to take a geopolitical risk, take climate. We may easily expect shocks of the same size, if not larger than what we experienced in the past. A bad arrangement has costs. The question is what lessons we can take now and what would be the way to make the best use of those lessons now that COVID is over and the trade-offs are back.
Yes, that's enough of looking back. Let's look forward and say, if we make use of those lessons, learn those lessons, what is the potential for the euro project in the next 25 years?
Awareness of leaving the architecture incomplete, I think, is a starting point, and the costs related to that. What I think is very important is that in order to do what is necessary, it is key to change the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think if one looks back 25 years and the lesson learned and what we have now, I think two elements clearly stand out in terms of differences. I think one has to build on those two elements. The first one is a green and digital transition. So the need to tackle the climate crisis, also to the competitiveness crisis of Europe in broader terms. So to what extent the policy should be geared towards putting ourselves in the right line to deliver on the green and digital transition. So this is one element. The second element is the geopolitical relevance of Europe and the Eurozone. Now, we are in a world of crude power politics. It's a world that is a bit at odds with the DNA of Europe. We tend to reason in terms of positive sum games. So integrating more with the rest, with the trade, with each other, we all gain. Mm-hmm. Now, in a world of crude politics, pure logical power, at best, you have a zero-sum games. At worst, you have negative or super negative gains where everybody loses. Mm-hmm. So I think here, in order for Europe not to be marginalized, if not sandwiched between, you know, great powers, especially now with the war very close to our borders, I think we need to realize that leaving these issues open would also damage us on both these fronts. Mm-hmm. If we do not complete banking union, capital markets union, very difficult to believe that one would deliver on the green transition. You need to mobilize private capital in order to deliver that. It's not only a question of public investment. And second, if we do not have a safe asset, we do not, again, banking union, but also fiscal union, difficult to believe that one would be able to sustain competition on the global area. So what we say in the paper is that we have to change tack. In certain cases, fine-tuning the objectives, making it politically credible. In other cases, the narrative is key for delivering on that front. And we say that the approach of thinking in terms of European public goods in the economic area, but also in the non-economic area, take security or defense, is key in changing the political perception and make us sharing sovereignty the way it's needed at the present juncture.
Is there the political will, though, to make those changes and to evolve the euro? That's where this process has often fallen short in the past.
Look, if we go back to the very beginning, we had Helmut Kohl, François Mitterrand, and Jacques Delors.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to the response to the COVID crisis, we had Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, and Ursula von der Leyen. I think the hope, at least personally, is that come the next European elections, that would gather sufficient dynamism and visionary leaders to push forward the frontier of integration. So this is the first order leadership question. One may be optimistic or less so, but without political leadership, we are not going to be able to make the decisive breakthrough that is needed.
But Tim, if you look from a distance, what you see in the euro area and more in general Europe, you see an aging society with large accumulated debt for good reason, because we survive many crises basically by borrowing, in part.
Mm-hmm.
More worrisome, a technology gap, which is very large with the US and narrowing with all the other regions in the world. So we cannot predict where politics go, but there is a very common basis, which is the idea that a stable, integrated economic area may be extremely beneficial to keep Europe standing. So this is the challenge. Seeing through the monetary arrangement, seeing through the fiscal arrangement, addressing very basic needs of Europe that I think it would be almost impossible to ignore or postpone.
We shall have to get together again in 25 years' time to discuss how this has all worked out. But for now, Marco and Giancarlo, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
So much to talk about that we didn't have time to get to. If you want to find out more, then the Policy Insight is a good place to start. It is number 126 from CEPR. It is called The First 25 Years of the Euro. The authors, Marco Butti and Giancarlo Cossetti.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. If you like what you hear, follow us. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Next week on Vox Talks, 1 year on, we investigate what really happened at Credit Suisse.